Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Sunday night, a three-day holiday weekend, which means many of you can sleep in tomorrow and stay up late with us tonight here on the eve of Memorial Day, our most thoughtful national holiday, a moment to pause and remember the sacrifices made by our military veterans, including the ultimate sacrifice made by many of them. Tonight, we'll learn about a program created with veterans in mind, specifically veterans who are facing death, often in a hospital, alone, and like the rest of us, unsure of what, if anything, comes next. Is this all there is, or does some part of us go on? We've all had that conversation in our heads at one time or another, and maybe we tamp it down a bit and try to stick it over there in the corner of our minds, but it pops back up whether we like it or not. We've talked often on this program about the subject, the afterlife, as well as the many people who've had glimpses of the other side through near-death experiences. One of the best-known NDE proponents is Danyon Brinkley, who's had multiple best-selling books on the subject and has taken all kinds of grief over the years. Not as well-known as what Danyon and others have put together to help ease the transition from this life to whatever might come next, to make the end a little less fearful, especially for veterans who are essentially alone. It's called The Twilight Brigade, and it came out of Danyon's own experiences, something he worked out with the Veterans Administration. In the second half tonight, he'll be here to tell the story about his multiple visits to the other side, how it led him to create the program I just mentioned. His co-author is Paul Perry, who has also worked with most of the best-known researchers and medical folks who have investigated the subject and co-wrote their books as well. That's in the second half tonight, minutes after we cross into Memorial Day. In the first half, we'll learn a bit about animals, the ones facing extinction, the ones being mismanaged by government agencies, the cruelty that occurs on such a large scale, but which can only exist if we don't call it out. The mass extinction event that's underway all over the planet right now, whether we like to admit it or not. Scientists call it the sixth mass extinction in Earth's history, and there are things we can do to lessen the impact. Wayne Pacelli of Animal Wellness Action, an animal welfare organization, returns to the program to update us on some of the animal issues that are front and center right now for activists, for Congress, for state lawmakers, and just for people like us who love animals. A lot of ground to cover. Wayne joins me in a few minutes. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have pulled together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from various media sources. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. And the stories there tonight are a few that relate to both halves of our program this evening. There's a detailed report about where things stand with the sixth great mass extinction, as well as the history of the previous five, which all occurred long before we humans were around to muck things up. So does that make it okay, since so many species have been wiped out in the past, either by volcanic activity or changes in the ocean or maybe an asteroid strike? Well, read it for yourself, and then we can talk about it. There's also a really good piece from The New Yorker, which has been on a roll lately, about why so many Victorians were interested in trying to communicate with the dead. We've mentioned it on this program in the past, the fact that some of the leading minds of that age were deeply interested in trying to make contact with the other side. How did they get involved, and were they on the lookout for hucksters and fakes? It's a really interesting piece. There's also a new interview from Keith Basterfield with one of the naval aviators who was involved in what is now a pretty famous and spectacular UFO case involving a variety of pilots and people in the Navy. Doug Kurth is one of the only aviators from the incident who has not spoken publicly, and now he has. Check it out. Somewhat related, I wanted to give a plug to an event coming up next weekend. The Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, SCU, a reputable bunch of scientists and investigators, is putting on a digital conference June 5th and 6th. It's an online-only event where the speakers and panelists will include Dr. Hal Puthoff, Dr. Michael Masters, Robert Powell, Rich Hoffman, a lot of people we've interviewed here on this program a few times, but although the event is next weekend, the deadline to sign up is June 1st. So if you plan to take part, better jump on that tomorrow. After you take a peek at Naps News, you can check out how to become a Coast Insider. If you subscribe for a year, the cost is 15 cents a day, gives you access to a huge archive of programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault, classics, all of them. You can listen as many times as you want, anytime you want. It's a great deal. Ditto for George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, where George interviews fascinating guests, covers cool topics, similar to what he does on this program. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the chicken and the family goat. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into those silky jammies and your toes into your favorite bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Wayne Pacelli and what you can do to help animals everywhere. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Wayne Pacelli is one of the best-known animal welfare, animal rights advocates in the world. He was previously the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the U.S. He's currently with Animal Wellness Action, is the author of a New York Times bestseller, The Bond, earned his B.A. in history and environmental studies from Yale University, and he always stirs the pot when he visits us here. Wayne, welcome back.
George, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Imagine my surprise last Sunday. I open up the Sunday New York Times, and there on the front page is a story about kangaroos, which is an issue that I know you and your group have worked on, that you and I have talked about a lot over the last year or so. And the story gives you a little punch in the ribs and implies that animal welfare people like you, who live far away from Australia, really shouldn't pretend to know what's good for kangaroos. Can you share me with us your reaction to that article as you read it, and what led you to become involved with the welfare of kangaroos to begin with?
Well, you know, a lot of people can't wrap their brains around animal exploitation. They try to look at the issue through the lens exclusively, you know, from the people who are causing the harm. And when I looked at this issue of kangaroos being killed for their skins to make athletic shoes, I decided I didn't want to be a bystander. So with Animal Wellness Action and our sister organization, the Center for a Humane Economy, we announced a global campaign called Kangaroos Are Not Shoes. You know, Australia is known for many, many things. And in terms of animals, it's known mainly for koalas and for kangaroos. In a year and a half, the entire global community kind of watched in horror as fires engulfed the continent. Some of the scientists in Australia said 3 billion, that's billion with a B, animals perished in these cataclysmic fires. When that happened, I really looked at this issue, looked at how humans are treating kangaroos, saw that the largest commercial slaughter in the world was being conducted annually there, not, you know, for local food or any other kind of utilitarian purpose within Australia, but to kill the kangaroos and market the products for some of the most popular athletic equipment in the world, soccer cleats. We found 70 models, George, of kangaroo-based soccer cleats made by Nike, Adidas, Puma, New Balance, the other shoe companies. And I said, my God, you know, how could we be engaging in this kind of commercial slaughter? Well, the New York Times a week ago ran that story, but decidedly from the kangaroo shooter's perspective. But that's, you know, we're used to that. The media don't always treat us perfectly when you look at animal issues. They look at this issue, as I said, from the lens of the people conducting the activity and don't really think about the animals who are at the center of the enterprise. But for you and your listeners, George, 2 million kangaroos killed every year, largely to make shoes that you can make with other fabrics, just not necessary in this day and age.
This was a sort of an issue you thought that animal welfare folks had solved, at least in the California market. You got some legislation enacted, but it wasn't solved after all.
Yes, in the early 70s, California, really kind of riding an understanding of endangered species throughout the world, what we were doing. We were killing leopards to make fur coats. We were killing other creatures to make skins and products that we would use in our daily lives. California said, no, we're going to stop that. We're going to stop the killing of kangaroos for shoes. It turns out that California has not been enforcing its law. So we literally went store to store retailer to retailer, looking at online sources and brick and mortar sources, and found that California was still selling kangaroo-based shoes. Again, a market of 40 million consumers, bigger than the entire market of Australia, which has 25 million people on the entire continent. So we're now getting that enforced, but we've gone far beyond California. We've got national legislation, the Kangaroo Protection Act, to forbid the sale of kangaroo parts in the U.S. We're working with European groups to try to ban the sale of kangaroo parts in the EU. We just don't think that Australia should be killing its iconic kangaroos on this scale to make shoes that we can fabricate with other substances and other goods.
What's been the attitude of the shoe companies and also of soccer players? I mean, have you broken through to them and let them know what's going on?
More and more, yes. I mean, I think that the shoe companies have been pretty quiet. You know, many of them, Adidas and Nike, tout their sustainability programs. They talk about their commitment to biodiversity. They even talk about their commitment to humane treatment. And it's pretty hard to reconcile this fact pattern with that kind of rhetoric. So they've been pretty quiet. Adidas and Nike do some good things with their shoes. You know, Adidas actually takes ocean plastic and now makes shoes from ocean plastic. I mean, dealing with a real pollutant and environmental problem, which is this plastic, which is all over the world, including in our oceans, and turning it into a good that we can use. So they like talking about that, but they don't like talking about their commitment and their central role in driving commercial slaughter. In terms of soccer players, I mean, David Beckham and others have spoken out about this through the years. We have a bunch of Olympic athletes from multiple sports. Heather Mitz, a two-time U.S. soccer gold medalist. David Verberg, a 400-meter track and field gold medalist. Dotsie Bouch, a cyclist, silver medal winner in London. They're speaking out about this and saying, hey, we are serious athletes. We're at the top of our sports, but we would never use kangaroo products in our shoes. We can do better than this in the 21st century.
You know, the tone of that article was, you don't know what you're talking about. You do-gooders from the U.S. Don't know what it's like to live with kangaroos. We manage them here, that if we don't shoot 2 million of them, they'll starve. And we're really good marksmen. That was the piece makes it point of like, oh, yeah, look, we went out with this guy. He shot this kangaroo right in the eye. Didn't hurt it at all. You know,
human beings have an incredible capacity to rationalize their cruelty. You know, they did talk about their marksmanship, and it's funny, they were blaming the farmers, saying, well, they're really the ones who are the butchers. They, you know, gut shoot the kangaroos, and we shoot them right in the head. The reality is these commercial shooters go out in the middle of the night. They try to get 50, 75 kangaroos in a night. They spotlight them and shoot them from their trucks. It could be 150 yards away, even 200 yards away. They can't identify the gender of the animals at that distance in the middle of the night. And it turns out that on that toll of 2 million kangaroos killed for commercial purposes, 400,000 of them are joeys, the babies, the kangaroo babies, who are in their mother's pouches or at the foot of the mother when they're shot. So how can you claim you're precise in your killing when you don't know if it's a male or female, and when the collateral damage is 400,000 joeys who are taken from their mother's pouches and, you know, have their heads bashed in on the back of the bumper of their truck or against the rock out in the outback somewhere? I think, again, it's one of these circumstances, George, where people try to make all sorts of excuses for what is demonstrably cruel behavior. These are the largest mammals in Australia. They've been around on the landscape for more than a million years. They're claiming, well, the kangaroos are going to starve. How could the kangaroos have lasted a million years? And the reality is, this is being driven by cattle and sheep ranchers. There are 90 million cattle and sheep on the Australian landscape. And many of these people see any kangaroos who are out there as competitors for the forage that they want the cattle and sheep to have. That's really what's driving this, as well as the profit incentive, that these folks, 3,000 of these shooters, are killing kangaroos and selling their parts for global commerce, and they've got willing buyers in the form of Nike and Adidas.
I look at, you know, what happened to Australia, the terrible drought, the brutal fires that wiped out so much land and livestock, and now this infestation of mice. It seems like in the bigger picture that we're not doing a very good job, or someone's not doing a very good job of being stewards of the land down there. It's mixed in with climate change that's ravaging their economy and the farmers and ranchers and the animals.
You wonder how animals, you know, can endure all of the assaults that we deliver to them. You know, we make their habitats less hospitable for them. We poison them, we shoot them, we eat up their habitat. And, you know, for me, you know, all of us can connect with products. Like, you know, we all buy shoes for athletics, you know, whether it's walking or running or tennis or soccer or whatever it may be. Here's something that connects us to these creatures. We can make simple choices in our life that choose life and decency and kindness and mercy, or just kind of a callous thoughtlessness. This is okay, I'll buy whatever I want. Someone's going to kill these animals, but who cares? And I think that, you know, most of us in society love animals. We are increasingly alert to the fact that they are conscious. They've got families. They suffer just like we can suffer if we're hurt or injured. And I think if we can do better than just, you know, allow them to be tormented and tortured and killed, especially for gratuitous or frivolous purposes, then most of us on our planet say we should act in a way that's responsible and humane and conscious about what happens to these other creatures. I think this is a simple campaign. You know, folks can go to kangaroosarenotshoes.org and learn about this campaign, get involved, support our national legislation, the Kangaroo Protection Act, so we can close off the United States market to these exports from Australia, and then our European brethren and sisters can do the same, and we can protect kangaroos throughout Australia.
Give me a sense of, you work with Congress a lot and have for a number of years. Give me a sense of what it's like now. What are the chances that that legislation might have, given that it doesn't seem like Congress pays attention to much of anything, you know, or people or animals?
Well, animals are an increasing concern throughout our society. You know, it's not just Democrats or just Republicans. It's people of every stripe, from left to right. So many of us are deeply concerned about animals. And I think that lawmakers, for all of the criticism that they get from the American public for divisiveness or, you know, focusing on the wrong issues, this is a popular cause in the United States. I estimate 35,000 animal welfare groups in the U.S. In 2019, it was rated as the number one cause in the United States, measured by number of volunteers and number of individual donors. There are a lot of issues, though, George. You know, you and I have talked about these subjects on Coast to Coast before. One of the great problems we face is the variety of forms of exploitation. And if we could just focus on one or two, I'd be confident we could knock those problems out pretty quickly. The problem is we've got dozens of forms of exploitation, from factory farming to animal fighting to killing of kangaroos for their skins for the global leather trade to, you know, you name it, animal testing and wild horses and burros being rounded up from our federal lands for no good reason. So that is the greatest problem we face, is the diversity of forms of exploitation. But when Congress is focused on this issue by the American public, things can happen. You know, I've been working, as you noted, in Congress for probably 25 or 30 years. We've passed 100 new federal laws and 100 amendments. And we're making big progress. We've banned animal fighting everywhere in the U.S. We have a national anti-cruelty statute. We've tackled wildlife trafficking, from ivory tusks to rhino horn. Now we're going after shark fins and the trade in bear gallbladders. There's a lot going on, and I really invite everyone who's concerned about animals to join us at Animal Wellness Action and drive change. That's the only way things have ever happened, is when people of conscience gather together and through their collective voices, they make changes.
I want to get into the big picture. Climate change, whatever the cause, is affecting animals everywhere. It's already wiped out a number of species. It's put a lot of others in danger. And, you know, I don't want to get into the argument about whether we caused it or not. I'm more interested in Is there something we can do about it that helps not only the planet and these species, but ourselves as well? We're talking with Wayne Pacelli of Animal Welfare Action, and we're going to Animal Wellness Action, and we're going to get into some of these other subjects, big picture stuff, in a moment here on Coast to Coast. We're talking with Wayne Pacelli of Animal Wellness Action, as well as the Center for Humane Economy. And as we've discussed before, Wayne has long campaigned on the idea that businesses which have animal cruelty sort of built into the business plan simply cannot be allowed to continue or have to change their ways. We're going to get into some specific examples of that coming up in our next segment. Wayne Pacelli of Animal Wellness Action. Let's talk big picture stuff. So I don't, you know, the larger picture of us humans as stewards of the planet and stewards of everything that lives on the planet. And I know people want to tune out if you want to talk about the cause of global climate change, but I don't think we can deny that change is underway and it's having incredible effects, deleterious effects on species, environments. I guess, you know, you would hear the argument about the causes of it and, the idea that species have died out in the past. So I guess maybe it's okay. Stuff happens, you know, species die out. We're, you know, what can we do about it? But in our case, you know, wiping out habitats and taking over, cutting down rainforests and using it for cattle grazing, things of that sort. I mean, human activity does have effects on everything else that lives on the planet with us, does it not?
Well, it does. And, you know, a lot of the talk has been around fossil fuels, and there's a big debate about using coal and oil and gas and what effect that is having on temperatures and the health of this planet. And whatever those specific contributions are there, I also want to point out that animal agriculture is an enormous contributor to this problem as well. 70 billion animals are raised every year, domesticated animals, on the land for human consumption. We've got 7 billion people on this planet, and in the United States, the average person eats 32 land animals. Globally, it's 10 land animals. You think about what's going on with the kangaroos in Australia. There are 90 million cattle and sheep on the land. That's really what's driving this. Our desire to raise these animals for food. A lot of us don't make the connection when it comes to what the impact on native wildlife is directly just by killing those animals so that the cattle and sheep can graze. But you look in the United States, this is the same issue. The use of cattle and sheep on our public lands is driving the roundups and the killing of wild horses and burros. You know, these animals consume a lot of food. They emit a tremendous volume of waste, whether it's flatulence or it's solid waste. You think about all of the crops that we grow in the United States. 80% of all the corn and soybeans that we raise, those vast fields of soybean and corn in Iowa and Illinois and Indiana and so many other Midwest states, 80% of that is going to animals who inefficiently convert that plant matter into animal protein. This, of course, has implications. It is emitting heat-trapping gases onto our planet. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization wrote a paper some years ago called Livestock's Long Shadow, basically said that animal agriculture is responsible for 15 to 20% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the world. I think that, you know, all of us require a healthy planet to live. And I think that, you know, we're putting our head in the sand by not recognizing that our consumption practices have consequences for the planet, for us and all of the animals on it. And I think it's bigger than fossil fuels. I think that it's a real look at animal agriculture, a real look at the other resource use that we engage in. And I think we can, you know, we're an incredible creative ingenuitive species. If we can diagnose the problem and then offer prescriptions, we can make this a more habitable and safer place for all of us, including human beings.
You realize, of course, better than most of us that people don't want to be told what they can eat. You tell people, don't eat meat, and they have a visceral reaction to it, as opposed to educating them about, you know, the effects of so much meat consumption, the urging, gentle urging, that maybe if you a meatless Monday kind of a thing could have a major impact. Just cut it out for a day could have a major impact on the planet, on their own health, things like that sort. You have to walk a fine line there, right?
No, you do, nobody wants to be a scold. Nobody wants to try to challenge people's freedom to do what they want. But you know, we live in a society. We live in a civilization. We're not just independent actors, and we do whatever we want. To hell with the rest of the people on the planet. I mean, just look at the numbers. Again, 70 billion land animals raised for food every year. Most of those animals are not just foraging off of grasses. Most of those animals are being fed by crops that we are raising. I mean, we are clearing rainforests in the Amazon to make soybean fields so we can feed those soybeans to pigs and cattle. I mean, we are diverting water resources to feed these animals. You know, you think about the waste. Think about 330 million Americans, George, and the waste that we produce. Most of the waste is treated. We have water treatment plants in communities throughout the United States. Well, we raise 10 billion animals in the U.S. Their waste is not treated. The pig waste goes into lagoons, and these are just cesspools of waste. The cattle produce enormous volumes of waste. Dairy cows produce enormous volumes of waste. I mean, this pollutes our groundwater. It pollutes our air. It releases heat-trapping gases on the planet. So the choices that we make have consequences. And it seems to me that people say, well, I should be able to do whatever I want, whenever I want. You know, sure, you can say that. And, of course, freedom and liberty are hugely important principles in our society, but we don't just look at those values alone when we make decisions. We look at how it affects our community, how it affects our neighbor, how it affects the global community in so many ways. And I think that what we're only asking people to do is take a serious-minded look at this. And I'll just pull back a little bit and talk just about the animal welfare. You know, I've been to factory farms. I've been to pig factories in the U.S. I've been to laying hen facilities. I've been to poultry plants. I've been to slaughterhouses. These are not particularly pretty sights. You know, I've been to egg laying hen facilities with 250,000 or 300,000 birds in cages. The cages are stacked 8 or 10 high at some of the biggest facilities. So you have to go, you have to walk up a catwalk to look at the birds at levels 5, 6, 7, and 8. And the birds are in small cages about the size of a microwave, 6 or 8 birds in each cage for side by side for as long as a football field, and as I said, stacked 8 high. Those birds live 12 to 18 months. They never once get out of their cages. They de-beak the birds. They trim or cut off the edge of their beak because in this overcrowded environment where they can't establish their normal social relationship, they will peck each other to death. So one of the ways that you blunt the effects of that cannibalism and that aggression is by, you know, denuding them of this weapon they've got on their beak. But this is an unnatural aggregation of animals in a facility. This is not what we're used to when you see animals historically in a pasture setting where they can run around and engage in normal behaviors and pick bugs and, interact occasionally, you know, a little aggressive, but never, you know, very rarely with animals killing each other as members of their social group. This is a very bizarre experiment that we've engaged in for the last 60 years when we moved animals from outdoor settings and put them in giant windowless buildings. This is bizarre. I think it's radical. And I think that any serious-minded person, you know, really needs to look at how we're raising animals and does it meet our basic test of decency and humanity in their treatment. And I think, no, it doesn't. I mean, we've domesticated these animals. We have responsibilities to treat them decently, and jamming them into a factory farm where they're so confined that they can't even stand up or turn around or freely extend their limbs is something that really any good person should be thinking about.
About chickens, egg-laying hens, you and your colleagues, your other animal welfare groups, combined and lobbied California lawmakers to install some changes in the egg production industry, and it was passed. And all the egg producers said, oh my gosh, this drives us out of business. We'll leave the state. It'll kill us. It didn't kill them. Right?
No, the world is changing. You know, it actually, George, first we went to the people. We didn't go to the legislators because a lot of them were very, very tied to the agribusiness corporations and organizations, trade associations, and they didn't want to take a serious look at these issues. But we put it in front of the people with a ballot measure, and despite millions of dollars spent against us when we put the measure on the ballot that just asked that animals who are able to walk and move around have that ability, that they're not so severely confined that they are immobilized for their entire lives, we wanted a landslide in California. And after that, we negotiated deals where more than 150 major food retailers, from McDonald's to Burger King to Costco to Kroger, every big name in American food retail, they've all made commitments now to phase out their purchasing of eggs that come from hens severely confined in battery cages and to opt for cage-free standards. Now, cage-free is not perfect. There are, you know, still some issues. But my God, it's so much better than to have a life where you can't even turn around or extend your limbs. And this is a relatively recent circumstance. This is something that's happened in the last 10 or 20 years, and now we're just really beginning to phase in these products, and you have all sorts of corporations that are stepping up that are now providing more humanely sourced products, and then you have all sorts of new companies that are providing plant-based products that have all of the characteristics and qualities of meats. You have substitutes that, again, are a product of human innovation and ingenuity. You know, I think, you think of factory farming. You know, this didn't happen where animals were jammed into windowless buildings before the early 1960s. I think this was a form of human innovation, but it was a form of human innovation detached from conscience. What we need is human innovation attached to conscience. Let's figure out ways that we can get food, and it's palatable, and it's delicious, and it's abundant, but it doesn't involve torturing animals. That is the human creativity and ingenuity harnessed for the good in our society.
Again, you know, as for me, I wouldn't want somebody telling me what I can or cannot eat, but I have made changes as well, and I think that, you know, over the years, and the options that are available now that you just mentioned, this meatless meat stuff, Beyond Meat and Impossible Meat, whatever the names are, it makes it so much easier for people to go ahead and give it a try one or two days a week instead of beef for dinner every night.
George, it's something that so many of us learned about when we were kids, say about veal, you know, young male calves raised for succulent veal. You know, when people were alerted to the fact that these poor, you know, young male calves were kept in a 22-inch wide crate and couldn't move so their muscles wouldn't develop so we could cut into their tender, you know, their tender flesh, a lot of people said, my God, you know, is it that valuable for me to have this succulent flesh that we're going to torment this poor juvenile animal? You know, think back farther in terms of our consumption practices. People were killing leopards for fur coats, and we were endangering the leopards in Asia and Africa just for a fur coat where we had plenty of other options. So I think there are very few people, George, who say, oh, we have zero responsibilities to animals. And you look back at the decisions that we've made societally, we said, yes, we're going to preserve endangered species. Californians and other voters said, yes, we're going to allow animals built to move to be able to move who are raised for food. The least we can do is give them a decent life and then maybe a decent death with humane slaughter. And now when we unleash our human ability to produce meat-like products, whether through plants, like, as you said, Impossible Foods or Beyond Meat or dozens of other companies, or now cell-based meat, we can create meat in a laboratory setting that is real tissue. It's animal tissue. It just happens to be the animal tissue without the brains and without the heart and the fully cognizant organism. I mean, if you can produce the same meat and not have a fully functioning organism who, you know, whose life was taken and who lived in miserable conditions, Why wouldn't we choose that? People say, well, it's gross to eat the animal tissue. Well, that's what you're eating. It is animal tissue that you're eating. You just happen to be taking the edible portion, and you're not killing a living creature who had a mother and who had a life that mattered to that creature.
I want to get into wild Mustangs. We can start on this side, and then if we need more time, we'll pick it up on the other side. You mentioned about the comparison to the kangaroos and how the pressure really comes from the cattle industry. The same is true for here. I mean, I've sort of lost track of the wild horses. I covered it for 25 years, and until this New York Times story a couple of weeks ago that exposed what many of us already knew, that the BLM, which manages this program, was sort of looking the other way, adopting out wild Mustangs and knowing that they're going to slaughter. What do you make of that?
Well, in 1971, George, because you've done so much reporting on this, you know that the Congress basically recognized American Mustangs, wild horses, and also burros as part of America's Western heritage, that these are symbols of the American West, and they were fast declining because ranchers and others were shooting them and poisoning them. They were being threatened by other factors, and we as a nation, through our federal lawmaking process, adopted a statute to protect them. Well, that statute has been subverted over the last 50 years, never more than now. There may be 90 or 100,000 horses in the West, in the vast reaches of our public lands. You know, one-third of the United States, 700 million acres, is held by the federal government, and a far larger portion than a third in the Western states. And one of the biggest landholders is the Bureau of Land Management, with about 260 million acres of land. The wild horses and burros are on that land, and they're sharing it with more than 4 million cattle and sheep. Those are exotic species, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that wild equids have been around what we now call North America for tens of thousands of years. And those creatures are part of North America's ecosystems. And yes, these animals were introduced by the Spanish as the West was being settled. But these creatures, in terms of their density and numbers, are just a fraction of the livestock. Yet, ranchers are blaming the wild horses and burros for eating forage. Well, that's what they do. We can manage those wild horse and burro numbers through humane methods, including fertility control, because, again, we have this human creative power. We've developed vaccines to deliver to the horses that can stop reproduction temporarily for them, and we can manage those populations humanely. But the ranchers, many of them, don't want them around. And our United States government, despite having a federal law, is rounding them up. And they're really working to round up 20 to 30,000 wild horses and burros a year, including under this administration. And the New York Times recently reported that the United States is promoting adoption of rounded up wild horses and burros. They're giving people $1,000 per horse or per burro to take them. These folks are pocketing the $1,000, and then after a short period, they are selling the horses or burros to kill buyers, and they're off on their way to Canada or Mexico to be slaughtered for human consumption with the meat exported to France, Belgium, or Japan. This is a disgrace. And it is a subversion of our federal law to protect wild horses and burros, and I don't think we should tolerate it in our country.
We're going to pick up that conversation on the other side, going into a break, talking with Wayne Pacelli of Animal Wellness Action.